The question is, are we prepared to deal with severe weather at any time during the year? Well, that was the question this last Saturday when we hosted a live broadcast of Tallahassee Talks from the Four Points Hotel. I've got that entire show for you right here, right now.
Tallahassee Talks with Brian Cerny, brought to you by Widen Glass, Tallahassee's first name in glass for your home or office, and by Merry Maids. Call Merry Maids. Relax, and it's done.
When you place a document in someone's hand, it should reach more than their head. It needs to reach their heart with compelling visuals and dramatic presentations, right down to the paper it's printed on. Rapid Press reaches the hearts of thousands of people every day with commercial printing and mailing services, for organizations that feed and house children, for businesses that bring vital products and services to our community, and for theaters, festivals, and orchestras reaching bigger audiences and bringing joy to life. Rapid Press, commercial printers since 1983.
For digital printing, offset printing, finishing, and mailing services, reach for Rapid Press. When you're ready to share your vision, excite your customers, and reach the hearts of your audience, reach for Rapid Press. You'll find them online at rapidpress.com or call 893-7346. 893-7346. Rapid Press, the power of print.
So here we are again, my friend. Thank you for joining me. On this occasion, we're bringing you our broadcast from this last Saturday when we were live at Four Points Hotel. This marvelous panel, six of our community's leaders responsible for emergency management. You're going to learn a lot, so stay with me.
We're going to get started right now by letting me take just a moment to introduce to you our panelists, and I have them all here right in front of me on my special list of official panelists. So that's important, right, Kevin? So, okay. So we'll start to my far right with Leroy Peck, who is the president of CONA, the Council on Neighborhood Associations. Leroy Peck is with us. And to his left, then I have Kevin Peters, who is director for Leon County Emergency Management. Thank you, Kevin, for being with us. And to my immediate right, I have Chief Jerome Gaines, Fire Chief for Tallahassee Fire Department, who has agreed that even if he gets an emergency call, he's going to stay right here with us throughout the next 2 hours. Is that right?
That's right.
Okay. So then to my far left, I have the very lovely Sharon Sharon Tyler. She is the executive director for the Capital Area Red Cross, and we've all agreed that she's not allowed to have any time off, apparently, for the next several months going forward. We're going to talk with her about that, too, because I don't think she's had much sleep lately. So we're concerned about Sharon, but she's got a great team around her over there at Capital Area Red Cross. And then to her right is Rob McGuire. Well, he's the general manager for City Utility, Electric Utility. And then, last but not least, David Merrick, who is to my immediate left here. Dave Merrick is the director for FSU's Department of Emergency Management and Homeland Security Program. So we're going to learn from these folks better what they do, how they serve us, and how we all can then be better prepared. I want to start with our first question, and we'll do that by directing this at Kevin Peters. Let's start with Kevin's. The first question is this: What is something we are not doing as a community that you wish we were doing? Looking at the gaps.
Yeah. Readiness is probably, community-wide readiness is probably one of the best things that we need to focus on. We talked a little bit pre-show about complacency with preparedness. I think all of us in the community, we're all aware of the hazards, and we all think about it. To me, it feels like it's a little bit like our personal health, you know. We all go to doctors, and doctors tell us, probably need to lose some weight, eat a little better, get your numbers right. So every January, New Year's, that's our goal. We're going to exercise. We're going to do better this year. And by January 15th or February 1st, the routine of normal life is kicked back in. And you know, while we know the right things we need to do, you know, daily life gets in the way of it all. And I think for preparedness, it's a very similar thing. You know, I lived in Florida my entire life. I remember as a kid hearing the same things. Be prepared for hurricanes, you know, 72 hours worth of supplies. As I've grown up and in the profession now and colleagues throughout the nation, it's the same message anywhere you live in this country. You know, be prepared, 72 hours supplies. You know, we as professional emergency managers, that's our constant message to the public, you know, to be ready, to have everything you need, 72 hours. But, you know, normal life, you know, it gets in the way, and we know, but it's the sustaining our preparedness, I think, is what kind of slows us down community-wide. Mm.
And I've heard Chief Gaines make that same comment, that it's easy to become complacent. Complacency, then, is our worst enemy when we talk about preparedness. Sharon, I was thinking of you in that regard too, in that there are probably for you a lot of ways in which you wish we were doing something that we're not, or maybe there are ways in which you think we could be doing something better. What do you see in that capacity? Where are the gaps from your point of view?
Well, I would agree with Kevin. I think it's important that individuals realize that they've got to be responsible for themselves and their own family for the 72 hours, and we talk about that, and it's not just about having a kit, you know, and which is important to have the kit and have all the supplies, but it's also important to people to realize that, you know, for those 72 hours, and sometimes a little bit more, that they need to be looking out not only for themselves and their family, but for their neighbors, and I love that they're partnering with all the neighborhood associations and helping people be more aware of their surroundings, and, you know, to understand that, for Rob, you know, the electricity may be off, and it may be off for 2 or 3 days, but to understand that and to be ready for that and to go ahead and assume that the electricity is going to be off. Mm. We're not going to have power. We're not going to have the infrastructure. And to be prepared for that, I think that's critical that people start realizing that, and not just in hurricane season, but year-round, because when storms, disasters can happen anytime.
Right. Here's a related question. If you had an unlimited budget and you could do whatever you wanted to do, what would you do with that money? And this is an open question for any of you.
Well, you know, I'll take this one real quick, or I'll start with it. You know, if we're talking about unlimited resources, I mean, we could do our public infrastructure, and if it's unlimited, you know, this hypothetical, you could also apply it to the private resources. We would want to build to Category 5, 200-mile-an-hour wind protection our structures. We would want to elevate structures above, you know, flood elevation, bridges, roads, and other infrastructure. Rob might want to talk a little bit about that, how that could do it for electric. But all of these things, you would try and stormproof them as best you could. If there were no limits on funding, if there was, and even things with fire protection systems and homes and businesses, you know, eliminating the daily threats, the mass disaster threats. Mm-hmm. All of it would be to these highest level standards, which are impossibly expensive to do in the real world. But in this hypothetical, you know, no limits on funding, we would build, you know, basically stormproof everything.
Yeah, and I think the person asking this question was thinking in terms of if you could take money off the table for the moment, mm-hmm. because that is, of course, the biggest obstacle. But and Rob, you might clearly point out the fact that many have called for more and more underground electrical wiring, right? So that sounds like a cool idea. Now, again, you have unlimited resources here. So is that how that works?
Well, that is the typical question after a storm event like this, is why don't we put everything underground? It is massively expensive. For the city's overhead infrastructure, we're talking a little less than $2 billion, with a B, dollars to convert it from overhead to underground. I think it's important to note that for the city, the last time we built a new neighborhood with overhead infrastructure was probably in the middle 1980s. This city has supported undergrounding for 30 years now. And you see that in our system. So, you know, like Kevin said, if you had unlimited money, we would look at doing more undergrounding. But we also need to understand there's unintended consequences of some of those decisions. Undergrounding helps when you have trees and wind. But if you have flooding, it creates a different scenario. And it creates a safety issue that might require us to take that part of the system out of service if there's going to be massive flooding. So in our areas of the city that are prone to flooding, you've got to take that into account. So, but it is a balance there of providing the reliability at a reasonable and cost. But if we had all the money in the world, we would do more undergrounding.
I love my Volvo. That's why I love Volcar. They take care of my Volvo the way I do. But my husband doesn't drive a Volvo. Good news, Volcar cares for all cars, and they give the same extra attention to detail and the same qualified precision every car requires. New or not so new, Carol and her team at Volcar are some of my most favorite people. She makes it a lot easier to understand what's going on with my car. And I trust her. And I think my husband does too, especially when he saw they charge less than his mechanic for the same service. So we're just one big happy family. Me, my Volvo, and my husband. With a little help from our friends at Volcar.
Volcar Sales and Service on Capitol Circle Northeast, just north of Miccosukee in Tallahassee. Volcar for all cars on the web at volcartally.com or call 942-4980. 942-4980.
Changing the face of talk radio in Tallahassee. Tallahassee Talks with Brian Cerny.
In that capacity, here's a related question. Are trees the biggest threat to our electric infrastructure?
Over half of our outages, whether they're on a day-to-day basis, taken outside of a storm event, over half of our outages in the city are related to trees. They're either tree limbs, or animal-related, and the animal-related is because the squirrels could go out on the trees and get on our wires. Mm. So that is our single biggest area of impact. When you get into a storm situation like we have with Hermine and Irma, we did not have cases where poles broke because of the wind loading or because of the design. It was because trees came down on the wires and broke the poles or pulled the wires down. So that is our single largest challenge. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the things we cherish in this community is the trees and the beauty that it brings, and it's part of what makes Tallahassee what it is.
Someone else asked, and this is really a policy question, how your department makes that decision to remove a tree. Some have told us that they reported a dead tree, and the dead tree didn't get removed, and then later the tree fell on the power lines. So how do you deal with, I guess, the prioritization of tree removal?
Well, there's a couple different pieces to that. One, we have a standing program that we have contractors out every day of the week trimming limbs back from the trees. Every 18 months, every inch of our overhead distribution system in the city is trimmed, where we will trim the trees back so that they're not touching the wires. Now, that's one change that the city has made since Hermine. We have historically trimmed the trees back 4 to 6 feet from the wires. We are now starting a program, starting with this next cycle that starts in October, of tree trimming, that we're going to be expanding that out to 5 to 9 feet over the next 18 months, and then 8 to 12 feet over the next cycle after that, to move the limbs farther back from the wires and potentially remove some what we call danger trees that might cause concerns for the system. The second half goes more closely to the direct question you ask. When we have trees that are out in the system that pose a danger to the system, to the electric system, if they're in the right of way, it's a much easier issue for us, and that we can go in and remove those trees if they're on public property and clear them out. When we get into private property, it becomes a more difficult issue. We will work with the private property owner and top and or remove the tree. But it does have to have a clear danger to our system. We have a full-time arborist staff on the electric utility that has both the background and as an arborist and the understanding and experience of electric operations and design, that's their job, is to work with our line clearing contractors and the community on tree issues. Hmm.
I wanted to direct a question to Chief Gaines, and this is especially for you, Chief. It says, do you feel that the city is well covered, or are they in need of more staff, more stations, more equipment, particularly in regard to the Tallahassee Fire Department?
Well, of course, we could always use more stations and equipment and personnel because we cover 702 square miles. But to get that type of service that we're talking about, type of equipment and facilities, you have to pay for that, and we know that if you put that against everything else that's going on in the community, as far as what a person is willing to spend their money on, that's not a high priority. So we make it work with what we have, and I am confident in the fact that we're prepared. I think we've shown that through the different incidents that have occurred here, that even with the resources we have, and then we have the support of the volunteer departments, we get things done.
Hmm. Anyone else want to reply on that?
Brian, let me add from the electric utility. I think we're well staffed for the day-to-day operations of a utility this size. No electric utility can have enough staff on their payroll and available to deal with a storm event like Hermine or Irma. Within our business, just like the comment earlier about neighbors helping neighbors, utilities operate in that manner. We have access to every other public power or municipally owned utility in the United States to bring resources in, the co-ops around the country, and the investor-owned utilities in our region, to where we can bring people in during storm events, and that's how utilities back each other up around this country. And it's and there's really not a lot of limits in how far folks will go. There were Florida utilities that went to New York during Superstorm Sandy. We're in discussions today about whether we send resources down to Puerto Rico to help Puerto Rico rebuild their electric infrastructure. We brought utilities from Louisiana, Nebraska, Michigan, and Ohio in to help Tallahassee. And when they were done helping us, they left here and went downstate and helped some of our peers in the central part of the state, just like we sent folks downstate. The day after we finished getting all of our customers online here, the next morning we had a crew of 30 people roll out of here and go to Gainesville and then Ocala and support them. So that's one of the ways, and I know, Chief, in the fire and police service, there's similar arrangements where the different organizations back each other up when we have a major event like an Irma or a Hermine to make sure that we have the staff we need to meet our customers' demands and restore the system. Mm.
If we had taken a direct hit from Irma, the devastation could have been much, much more severe.
Well, I think it goes back to what Rob was saying. And, we have the resources to do what we do on a daily basis. And those types of incidents, no matter how much money you have and how many resources you might have, no one can prepare for that type of devastation. And the only way we can do it is, as Rob said, and it's the same in the fire service and probably any profession you would find, there's always assistance from other agencies in that profession. And so if Tallahassee would have taken the type of hit that some communities have taken, we would get that same level of support as they have received. Mm-hmm. And so no one's in this alone. Mm-hmm. It's a group effort.
My dog was in bad shape, and I was scared. I had never seen her so sick, and my mind was racing. What to do? Who to call? I mean, I raised her from a puppy. She's like my best friend. A few years ago, she developed diabetes, and I've been following her daily regimen carefully. But that morning, something just wasn't right. She could barely move, and I thought, I'm losing my dog. I called a friend, and he said, call Dr. Pliskin. So I called Mahan Animal Clinic. They put me through immediately, and Dr. Pliskin said to get her there right away. Turns out, her blood sugar had dropped dramatically, but he knew exactly what to do. I guess you know. There's no other place I would go knowing that Mahan Animal Clinic and Dr. Pliskin are there for me and Aerith.
Special people and special care for those you love. Mahan Animal Clinic on Mahan Drive near Costco. On the web at mahananimalclinic.com or call 402-0557. More beauty, less bully. Tallahassee Talks with Brian Cerny.
We are back. We are here with you live at Four Points Hotel in Tallahassee, bringing you Tallahassee Talks with Brian Cerny, our panel of public officials gathered to help answer your questions and advise us all how we can be better prepared to deal with severe weather now and at any time during the year. Dave, it seems to me you spend a lot of your time not only in class helping other people think this way, you've done a lot of this research yourself. And this is a question that I would like you to help us with from your humble point of view. Do you think we are better prepared now than we were before Hurricane Hermine? Has there been a ramping up or a growth spurt there in our understanding? So go back to pre-Hermine and think about where we are today.
Sure. The unfortunate truth is that experience is one of the best teachers. And that's not only true for those of us who do this for a living, but it's particularly true for the people living in the community. So Hermine was a fantastic teacher in what it means to be prepared and what's required at the individual household level so that people can be not only survive but somewhat be comfortable when the power's out for a significant amount of time. And I think that we saw that with Irma. Here in Tallahassee, I think people were in a better frame of mind and more prepared simply because they had that teacher a year ago come through and show them what can actually happen.
And we've talked about this a bit too, preparedness versus, let's say, or in comparison, resiliency.
In my mind, I think that resiliency is the ability to kind of withstand that damage, and I think Rob could probably talk about that a little bit. As we build new infrastructure, we build it more resilient. It's less likely to fall over due to wind and things like that. And preparedness, I think is a frame of mind, and we focus preparedness a lot on the population itself. And are those households ready to feed themselves, have water, prescription medication, take care of their pets,
yeah,
all those types of things.
Yeah.
So they kind of fit together. Preparedness and resiliency fit together, but kind of two sides of a different coin.
So resiliency then is a question of what? Doing the best you can with what you have?
To some extent, yeah. There's never what I call the bottomless bucket of money, either before or after a disaster. I mean, we have to live within whatever means we're given. I think everybody at this table would love to see more money for, Chief Gaines talked about more equipment, and I'm sure Rob would love to see more money for undergrounding and some other things. I know Kevin would. So, that money is, we're always going to have to live within those means. Mm. But we can be smart about that. And, after Hurricane Andrew hit South Florida, we saw increased building codes or more stringent building mm-hmm. codes put into place for site-built homes
right.
Throughout the state. And I'll tell you from my experience in Collier County after Irma, which came through as a Category 3, I think we saw the direct impact of those stronger building codes. I mean, the vast majority of site-built structures were not suffering significant wind damage. Uh-huh. So we can do things that don't necessarily cost a lot of money, just require a little bit of planning and forethought.
Sharon, I think about you in that capacity because it seems to me that preparedness and resiliency includes this ability to reply, to respond.
Preparedness is the first part, I think, of being resilient. records and data show that for every dollar spent in preparedness, it saves $4 in recovery. And so one of our mantra has been forever, you know, that we want to help our communities prepare for, respond to, and then recover from disasters. And so that's who we are and what we try to do. And looking at this, when you broached the question to begin with, I was thinking about it, and I thought one of the things I wrote down was community resilience is the sustained ability to withstand, adapt to, and recover from adversity. And so, like I said, I think preparedness is just the first part of it. And yes, we will be in Houston and the surrounding South Texas, Southeast Texas for many, many years helping them recover, because this is something we're still actually in response mode as well. Part of it is in recovery mode, but much of it is still in response mode. Same thing with South Florida and Puerto Rico and the Virgin Islands. And I will say for that, sometimes you can have all the resources and money in the world, because I can guarantee you all that stuff is being sent to the islands down there. But if you don't have, when you've got such broken infrastructure down there, we can't get to parts of it. We just physically cannot get to.
And have the personnel, the truck drivers, are apparently in short supply.
There's a lot of things in short supply, and everyone is trying to reach out and help get the stuff to them. But again, you've got, you know, villages and parts of the islands that are inaccessible, and so they're having to really use extreme methods that we've never used before. Back in Harvey, we actually, this is something I had the hardest time getting my head around. We were having to deliver our volunteers in helicopters to get to areas that were inaccessible any other way. You know, that's something outside. I've been with Red Cross for 14 years, and then never had I done that. We actually usually, boats we have used, of course, we've all watched the TV shows and seen the images of all the boats that
we use.
And, so it's been incredible.
But to imagine helicopters in a domestic situation, was a continental situation. It is a bit odd, isn't it, to think that way? But that is exactly what had to happen, and is apparently ongoing. And certainly our neighbors in Puerto Rico are another example. If, in fact, resiliency is this ability to deal with crisis and then progress, to move forward, what are examples of that in our community?
Well, sort of go back a little bit from the electric utility perspective. That's something we plan for routinely and design for routinely. Part of our standards for years had been that when we're laying out the design of our system, and every electric utility does this, we try to have different ways to feed customers from different paths.
Redundancy. Yeah.
So that there's some redundancy, because that's some part of the resiliency question, so that if we have damage in one area of our system, can we bring it power from another way? Now, that doesn't always work, because you've got to look at the nature of the damage. But that is one of the areas that we do on a day-to-day basis. The other area is the money and the commitment that is made to do the preventative maintenance, the inspection, the storm hardening, those types of activities that we do as a routine course of our business to harden the system. It was like the discussion about the codes being changed after Andrew. In our business, we changed some of the design standards and hardening standards for our overhead distribution and transmission system, and to make it more designed better so that you don't have the wind damage. And we saw that with Harvey, or with Hermine and with Irma. It wasn't winds that took down our facilities. It was trees that took out our facilities. And then there's other things. I think the activities in Leroy can add into this that have happened the last year in this community with the neighborhoods, and the concerted effort for more organized coordination with the neighborhoods and the governmental entities to make sure that we are better prepared, and that
neighbors are better prepared to help neighbors when we have a vet.
Let's talk to Leroy about that. You are the president of CONA, the Council of Neighborhood Associations, which means to me that you're in touch with these various neighborhoods and communities within Tallahassee. Storms don't impact these various neighborhoods in the same way, do they?
No. And it really depends on when the neighborhood was established. If it was in the last 20 to 30 years, they are planned unit developments, and as Rob alluded to earlier, most of them have underground utilities. There are also homeowners associations versus neighborhood associations. Homeowners associations have resources simply because they levy fees. Neighborhood associations are voluntary groups, and so you're at the will and pleasure of the individual homeowners. And so economics becomes an issue. After Hermine, I sat through some of the after-action meetings with some of the various people on this panel, and so many things we heard from people had to do with food spoilage and basically some inconveniences. There were complaints about trees. There were complaints about the response of city and county government. And the thing that became obvious was that we needed to do a better job of training our neighborhood leadership on how to respond. And so our friends with Red Cross, city and county government, emergency management, and every training, and I'm a retired law enforcement officer also, and every FEMA training that I've had tells us, you know, individuals need to be prepared to stand on their own for 5 to 7 days. It'll take that long for government to right itself and the response of recovery efforts to begin. And so after Hermine and after that series of meetings, training became a major issue for neighborhood leaders. And so
now we're really talking. Tallahassee Talks with Brian Cerny.
Over the last year or so, we saw those trainings take place with Red Cross and city government on emergency management. And so this most recent event, we saw the benefits of that. Because if you went to any local store in the week leading up to Irma, it was like a combat zone. The shelves were barren because people had stocked up. Stuff like dry ice you couldn't find because people prepared weeks out. Plywood. All of the local stores had to order additional supplies because people bought it early. And so the preparation process was great. Nobody knows our neighborhoods better than the people who live in them. Mm. And so getting the neighborhood leadership to understand, you need to know who in your neighborhood has special needs. If you have elderly, if you have people who are on ventilators or other medical devices that need electricity, you need to know where those people are. Because in a disaster, the power is going to go out. It's not a question of whether or not it's going to go out. It's when it's going to go out. It is going to go out. So we need to be prepared to deal with that. So stuff like batteries. One of the other things that came from Hermine was the ability to communicate with the public. And so in that instance, we saw Facebook take front and center.
Yeah.
This round, we saw social media. With Irma, we saw social media play a major role. Now, I've traveled around and sent some different places, but Tallahassee just has a special appeal. And trees are a part of that appeal. We love them when it's sunny, and we hate them when the wind blows. But it is a part of the character of this community.
Yeah.
One of the other unique things with Tallahassee, you talked about the sharing and people kind of helping each other. And that's really a part of the identity of Tallahassee.
That is the whole point of this broadcast this morning. We've devoted our entire show, Tallahassee Talks with Brian Cerny. We wanted to make sure that you had opportunity to be a part of this conversation. We've had a couple of questions come our way by way of Facebook here. I see a couple. And someone had tweeted a bit earlier. This is Tammy in Crawfordville. And she's asking, how has the Central Communications Facility, I think she's talking about the public safety facility over here in Eastwood, how has it contributed or added to our preparedness? Maybe, Kevin, you want to take that one first?
Yeah. You know, if you go back before the complex, emergency operations was handled from two coordinated locations. You had a county emergency operations center, which at the time was in the administration building of the Leon County Jail, and a city coordination center that was at the Tallahassee Police Department on 7th Avenue. Neither facility was large enough to really host a full integrated emergency operations center. So there was a lot of liaison work, a lot of conference call work, and I think during that era, I think we were lucky that we didn't have the Hermine or the Irma or something of great significance. We were able to meet the needs of the community in that style of coordination, but we're very lucky. Mother Nature was kind to us during that era. With the public safety complex now, in addition to the daily services that are coordinated through the consolidated dispatch when you call 911, a 911 call comes in and it's dispatched from the same facility. Prior to that, if you called 911 in the old system, your call may have to go from one dispatch center from the city to the county or vice versa, depending on which emergency service you needed. We're saving time. We streamline that process. So that's a big save every day for people who may have a personal emergency in their life and they've called for help. But from the Emergency Operations Center, the disaster coordination point of view, we can all come together. Rob McGarrah and his team, they can sit next to their counterparts from Talcon Electric and work issues at Electric and in some of these areas where they're very close. Same thing with our public works crews. City road clearing and county road clearing are side by side. Sharon and the Red Cross are sitting with the Salvation Army and other human services groups. We have the ability to bring all of the people we need together at one place to facilitate an emergency response, because it's no one group can do it alone. You can't do it in a vacuum. Having the access to information, having the access to the different representatives allows us to coordinate and facilitate better activities to respond to the needs of the community in that immediate aftermath from a disaster.
Hmm. Anyone else wanted to speak to that?
Well, I'd like to say that when I've been here 3 years, and when I first arrived here, Hermine was the first incident that facility and that how it was structured was truly tested. And I can tell you from personal observation that if you compare Hermine to Irma, it's a night and day response. What happened after Hermine was we learned things. We realized we wanted to be better prepared, better communication, better how we were structured and how information flowed. And so there were some changes that were made behind the scene, improved training. We reached out to the neighborhoods and educated the neighborhoods more about being prepared and so forth. And we saw a better response in Irma. And as we continue to have these incidents, we will continue to improve on our process to make sure that we're providing the service to the citizens. But when you go back, I want to go back a second. We talked about resiliency.
Right.
Resiliency is something, the ability for an organization or an individual to spring back, to bounce back to normalcy. But this is what I know. No matter what incident it is, the resiliency is in the hearts and the minds and the souls of the individuals that live in that community. If the community has that desire to spring back and go back to normalcy and put forth all the effort necessary in order to go back to that, that's how that community recovers that much quicker. So that's where the resiliency is.
And David, that reminds me of some of the things that you've told me about how you spend your time. What are you contributing more so now than you were perhaps before?
Well, this is something that's been happening over a long period of time. I think that the training and education about how emergencies and disasters should be managed has improved greatly over the past 10, 15, 20 years. I mean, if you go back not that long ago, there wasn't an awful lot of professional level training for people who were doing the job. And I think that we're doing a much better job as a profession and as a community of responders to kind of take the lessons that we're learning, put it into an institutionalized set of training. FEMA does a nice job, but even the individual states, here in Florida has an active association of people who focus on this type of training. I think we're doing a much better job of making sure that the people who are actually doing the job are prepared for it with the latest lessons learned. And a lot of that comes from the fact that our program has a very strong ethic that students I can talk to them all day, and I can teach them all day, and that's fine. But we need to provide them with opportunities to learn how it actually works in the real world, preferably before they graduate.
Indeed. And Brian, just an example of some of the things that we partnered with David and his colleagues there. You know, we actively take interns through their program. We had two of them work during Irma. They wanted to volunteer and be in the EOC, but that's a good opportunity for us to impart that, what David talked about, that real world experience with them. And it's also an opportunity for somebody like me who's been out of school quite a while, and I'm not going back actively in classes, but to learn a little bit from the interns, the things that they're hearing in class, the research that David and his colleagues are bringing to the students. We're getting that back out of the internships. And we've also worked with them, and they've done several disaster exercises. They did our hurricane exercise in June to help us get ready for this hurricane season. So there's a very, very close working relationship, and we're seeing the results of this collaboration every year with FSU.
Folks, we're going to take another quick break here just to thank our sponsors for being a part of today's broadcast. You are in tune with Tallahassee Talks with Brian Cerny. Stay with me. We'll be right back.
Widen Glass takes care of Tallahassee business. Local contractors know Widen Glass has been taking care of business since 1945. They prefer Widen Glass because of their precise window glass replacement, masterful shower enclosures, and storefront glass. Widen Glass will take care of you to your complete satisfaction. That's been Widen's way of doing business for over 70 years. When you call Widen Glass, you're dealing with experienced, reliable professionals who offer only the best, like Widen's top-of-the-line bath enclosures that provide style and luxury at an affordable price. Eye-catching storefronts are a specialty at Widen Glass. We'll help you design it and install it. We've done hundreds of storefronts in the Tallahassee area. That's why Widen is known for taking care of business. Widen Glass, the first name in glass replacement. Call 222-5781.
The most talked about topics in town. Tallahassee Talks with Brian Cerny.
We're back. We are live. We are Tallahassee Talks with Brian Cerny. Thank you for joining me, my friend, on this next exciting episode of this here fine radio show, which comes to you every Saturday here. So we've assembled this marvelous panel, people who themselves have dedicated their lives in professional service, in public service. Kevin Peters, he's the director of Leon County Emergency Management. Dave Merrick here, who is the academician among us. And then we've got Rob McGuire. He's head of the Tallahassee Electric Utility. Chief Jerome Gaines is our fire chief. Sharon Tyler over here, God help her, who apparently is not allowed to take a break, so she just keeps running. She's like the ever-ready battery bunny. So she's heading up the local chapter, Capital Area American Red Cross, and our good friend Leroy Peck, who's down here talking about neighborhood associations. And I wanted to kind of come back to that. Leroy, you were helpful in us better understanding how these various neighborhoods and how the associations are impacted. And the point being that if you live in Frenchtown, the way in which a storm, a major hurricane particularly, would impact your life may be quite different than a family who lives in, let's say, Killarn or Southwood. And that's not just economic, is it?
No, it's not. You're talking about, in the city core itself, you're generally talking about older structures that were built 40, 50 years ago. So they weren't built to current code. And so they can't withstand the wiles of nature as a home that was built in the last 15 to 20 years would. The codes changed. In fact, there are codes now. In some cases, there were no building codes when those structures were put up. But in a disaster, when we talk about Killarn and Southwood and Frenchtown and South City, and or even the public housing projects or neighborhoods, your account balance matters until the lights go out. Once the lights go out, it doesn't matter what your account balance is, you can't access it. When the disaster hits, it doesn't make any difference whether you're hooking a ride on a school bus or in your own RV. If you can't get gas or diesel, it doesn't matter. And so disasters have a way of leveling the playing field, and everybody goes into survival mode. And at that point, it's when your relationship with your neighbors become critical. Mm. Because at that point, all we have is each other.
In that way, I wanted to throw this in front of you too, Leroy. When a curfew is issued, and that curfew is intended for good reasons by virtue of those in positions of authority, they're looking for ways to better protect and preserve the community. How does that curfew impact people who are in low-income situations? When they aren't able to go to work, they're on an hourly wage, they're then prohibited from making money for the next 24, 48 hours. Is that a concern to you?
Well, in situations like this, most of those jobs aren't going to be open anyway. So there's no reason to be out. And so the mission then for emergency service providers becomes to protect and preserve life. So a lot of the commercial areas, for example, would be ghost towns. Mm-hmm. And so a part of protecting that property is being able to control where people are and when they're there. And so I don't care how bad the situation, there is somebody who will try to exploit it for personal gain.
Yeah.
Whether it's price gouging at the gas pumps or charging $100 for a sheet of plywood or smashing a storefront to get a TV or a pair of tennis shoes. Mm. There are people that will try to take advantage of a bad situation and further victimize victims. So curfews in that sense are a good thing.
They're a good thing, and yet with those unintended consequences a part of that, it's got to be a very tough decision, Kevin, when people are trying to decide what to do within the next hour. I mean, because a lot of these decisions are hour by hour, are they not?
Yeah, you know, definitely as a lot of its factors of the storms we're facing increasing strength, decreasing strength, and what our, you know, we're trying to estimate what the actual impacts will be. And, you know, there's a lot of uncertainty when it comes to these hurricanes. And I get back to the previous answer about the benefits of the EOC. That's the type of information that we can use to leverage for those decisions. You know, we can ask Rob, what's the status? I mean, what are we looking at with power lines down? How dangerous is it in the community? You know, we have our friends with the police and sheriff's office, and they're giving us updates on roads that are passable or impassable, whether it's from a high wind event like Irma and Hermine with trees down, or it could be flooding. With our situation, though, nighttime hours, a lot of road hazards potentially out there. That's a big consideration is keeping people safe, because they may not necessarily be able to see the hazards that they may be facing if they were to go out, you know, between the 9 p.m. and the 7 a.m. hours. And it certainly wasn't to inconvenience. Truly, the intent is to keep people safe. And like Leroy said, it's, you know, we want people to be safe. You know, a lot of businesses that might be open late weren't open, and just it's that time to kind of hunker down and stay safe and do what you need to do during the daylight hours.
Right. And then you have to think about how that impacts law enforcement, because the curfew now is going to have to be enforced if it's going to be, you know, complied with. And county and city may say, hey, guys, we don't have the budget to put more people out on the street to enforce the curfew that you've just called for.
Well, and actually, during storms like that, the way that law enforcement staffs with their Alpha Bravo shift scheduling, it actually puts more law enforcement officers on the road for a shift. Mm. So they're actually in a better position to be out and be eyes on the community, and they're in a little bit better position to enforce those types of orders, actually, in a storm situation. So it should be a comforting notion to the community that during storms, because what they can do, they can bring on the people that would normally be detectives. They're available for storm service. You know, the plainclothes guys are doing certain things.
Yeah.
The rotating shifts kind of change to where you have more folks on your day shift and more folks on your night shift. So the security coverage, if you will, it actually increases when they go to their Alpha Bravo scheduling, because the shifts kind of go out the window and it's split. Everybody's all hands on deck, A and
right,
B. So
that
should be a comfort to the community to know that we have plans and processes.
Yeah.
And Laura, as a former law enforcement officer, could speak a little more to that possibly.
Yeah, I wanted to chime in a little bit, because even with curfews in place, there's it's kind of this common sense thing, and common sense doesn't go away. If you're dealing with somebody who say that they're out violating a curfew, but they're coming from taking care of grandma's house and now trying to get home, that's something that can be worked through. So it's evaluated on a case by case basis, not a zero tolerance, lock them up, throw away the key kind of thing, mentality.
Brian, I want to chime in just sort of on a side note. There's been a couple times during the morning we've talked about the financial impacts of the storm. I want to make sure everybody understands when we go into storm mode like that, we don't talk dollars and cents. Hmm. The whole discussion, whether it's at the EOC or whether it's within our individual operations, is what are the resources we need to get the customers back or to deal with the issue in the community, to open the roads, to clear the roads. And that's tied into doing that in a safe manner for our team and our customers and our citizens. And that is one of the, I've had friends and neighbors ask me, well, how much throttling was electric given during the storms? You know, how much were we throttled back or held back because of money? We didn't talk money throughout all that. Now, we account for it. We collect the charges. We seek reimbursements from FEMA. We always try to do things in the most cost-effective manner. But the most important priority when we get into a storm response is what do we have to do to support the community in a safe and effective manner. End of discussion.
Hey, folks, welcome back to Truck and Car Concepts. It is tailgate season. It's time to secure your tailgate items. We can do that with the tonneau covers. We do alarm systems, both in the bed and the vehicle itself. And we also do camper shells or toppers. Not only that, let's dress your truck up. We got Nerf bars, we do window tinting, car stereos. Bringing out the tailgate pong. Everybody loves to play tailgate pong. Come on down to Truck and Car Concepts and get yourself ready for tailgating. 656-8800.
Good morning, friends. This is your friend, Dr. Benjamin Franklin. We're talking with Brian Cerny on Tallahassee Talks.
It's an interesting comment, Rob. And by the way, this would be a great segue to say, how about a shout out for all of the linemen and line women who are out there on the ground putting their lives at risk, dealing with high voltage. When you want to talk about the real heroes in the room, let's not forget law enforcement, electric service, utility folks, and all of those people that are part of your organization, Rob. Firefighters. Do I need to say this again? These are the people who deserve a lot of our appreciation and thanks. And I would pose this to the panel, that when you see the sort of public relations dust up that's going on, it's got to feel a bit disheartening, I would suppose. Certainly, maybe you're just rolling your eyes like the rest of us. But meanwhile, you got the job done as best you could. And I noticed, if I can say this too, this year in preparation for Irma, the communication was dramatically more emphatic. And I saw Kevin's department, Rob's department, the fire department, all of you going even further to say, folks, we need to be prepared. We need you to know what we know. And so I thought that that effort was salutary, and I thought that it was probably the result of lessons learned. Right?
You're right on there, Brian. That was one of the – when we had our community listening sessions after Hermine, we had five of them across the different quadrants of our community. That was the overwhelming message that was given to us, is communicate better with this, communicate with more methods. We were using social media and Facebook. Leroy talked about that during Hermine, and putting out press releases and keeping our government websites up to date with information. But there were more things we could do. We partnered with WFSU Radio, they're part of the Florida Emergency Radio Network, I believe is what they call it. And they had a couple of reporters stationed at the Public Safety Complex.
Right, and Tom Flanagan.
Yeah, Tom Flanagan was back.
Fabulous job.
Yeah, he was
way
back
to go,
at
Tom.
Their studio. Yeah, Tom is a great, great partner. We were able to give, you know, hourly or every 2 hour updates throughout the night and day as Irma was getting closer, and that was a real good opportunity because we could come right from the operations center, maybe finished up a briefing or a conference call. We could come down with the latest information, supplement what they were getting from their meteorologist. I believe Jeff Huffman is their meteorologist that provides the weather specifics.
Right.
We could break it down to the what's that mean locally to us,
yeah.
and what are we doing currently.
Yeah.
So it was
fantastic.
Keeping the live finger on the pulse, so to speak.
In that capacity, I wanted to ask each of you this too. This is a question that came earlier in the week, and it says, "What is the highest complaint to misunderstanding ratio topic that you did deal with?" So I think the point is when people are complaining about a process that they really just don't understand, okay, for example, the restoration of power, okay? Rob's over here. He's on the floor right now, folks. He just fell out of his chair. The restoration of power and how the electric grid works. So, Rob...
you know, in any storm situation or outage situation, that, you know, the big questions are, when's my lights going to get back on and why am I last? Whole lot of subset questions from that. Are people getting special treatment? Are we getting special direction? You know, our business generally follows the same practice, whether you're an investor-owned utility, a municipally-owned utility, or cooperative. We have to start where we generate and get the electricity from and make sure that's working. Then we have to look at our high-voltage wires, what we call our transmission system. It would be analogous on a road system to an interstate system. And that's how we move the power from the power plants around the community. We have to get that working. Then we get to start talking about customers. And within the customers, there are priorities. Our first priority is going to be getting places like hospitals, nursing homes, critical community services facilities, the sewage treatment plant systems up. Then we move into broader medical communities, maybe assisted living, communications facilities, those other things that are needed into the community. Once we work through those priorities, it really becomes a numbers game after that. We're looking at where the largest pockets of outages are to where we can get the most customers back the quickest. You may have an outage that has 500 people out and an outage that has 2 people out, and it will take the exact same amount of resources and time and energy on our team's part to get those 2 outages fixed. So we're going to go get the 500 back first. Hmm. And
So it's almost a triage situation for
yes.
you.
Yes.
Yeah.
And that's very true. And that's a standard process that we all use. And then you get down to the end of the outages where you get into the small pockets. It may be 1 or 2 customers. It may be a single customer whose service is damaged. Those end up being towards the latter part of the process. Probably the most misunderstood piece is whether once you've let us know you're out, or do we know you're out? And the answer is we know who's out after the calls have come in. It just takes time to walk through that priority and that process to get customers back on. And it's different. You may have 2 different – I've got a good friend that during Hermine, they were out for 5 days. They didn't lose power during Irma. And a lot of it depends on how the storm hits the community, you know, what fails in the area and what causes it. But we follow that same process all the way through. Mm. And, you know, I think there are some misconceptions that we're given directions to go fix this area or go get this customer back. I can tell you I've only been given one direction when we go into storm events, and that is to get the customers back as quick as we can in a safe manner for our customers and our employees.
And safety is a big part of that for yes. those that are on the ground. And we had a question come in from, this was from Robert in the Killarn area, and he said, what is the role of the mayor and the city and the county commissioners during emergencies?
Yeah, I know. The way that the state of Florida works is it's a state to county to city process. The governor can declare a state of emergency for parts of the state of Florida, the entire state of Florida, whatever the impacted area. At the local level, the county declares the state of emergency. The chairman of the county commission is considered the chief elected official, and signs on the declaration and all the other like our curfew order that was signed by our county chairperson. So cities, and this isn't just here in Lincoln County, this is statewide. Cities coordinate through their county. County coordinates with the state of Florida. That doesn't mean that the mayor and the city commission have no responsibility for protecting the citizens of the city. They still have, the responsibility to provide the emergency services. Same thing with the county. We have the responsibility to provide. It's more of an administrative nature in that, but that's the administrative nature. It's the state to county to city. Again, with the how we are postured with the public safety complex.
Bringing you whatever Tallahassee is talking about this week. Tallahassee Talks with Brian Cerny.
Our city and county, or county administrator and city manager, they come together at the public safety complex and they develop items or issues at the policy level that may need to be dealt with. We can handle it from the operations level in the EOC, or they'll work with the elected officials to collaboratively, like the curfew issue. That's a policy level issue that the concurrence of the mayor, the chair, and the county sheriff need to come together on things like that.
Right. I think a lot of our listeners are asking, are you better prepared to work with one another, cooperate with one another, communicate with one another? Sharon, you're over there having to supervise all of these people. I mean, right? Isn't this part of your role?
I would say partner with all of them.
Oh, okay.
Supervise.
Help them get along with each other, right? Isn't that part of it?
Well, I actually think that both during Ramin and Irma, that the strong partnerships were one of the highlights.
Yeah.
I think we don't just partner during storms. It's a year-round thing, just like we don't start getting prepared when a system enters the Gulf. We're year-round prepared, and so we all partner together year-round, and I think that makes for a strong team and makes for a stronger community. Mm.
Can I say something, Brian?
Yes, please.
You asked that question a month ago about, the government officials and so forth. And, this is how I see this is as a firefighter, be it working electric, FSU, Red Cross neighborhoods, emergency management, we all have we're committed to doing the best job possible for the organization we represent. But I can tell you in instances like these or any emergency, we put that aside and we come together. We're like a family. And in a family, there are going to be disagreements at times. Mm-hmm. But our primary mission as a family is to make sure that the family's needs are being taken care of. And that's how I see any type of incident we have, regardless of what the position might be. And Kevin said it best. In the EOC, the family comes together, be it elected official, department director, or appointed, or whatever, and those decisions are made together as a family to say, what can we do to make sure that our extended family, the citizens, their needs are being taken care of? And I saw that happen day in and day out in both incidents.
And we're a hub, are we not? I appreciate that comment because it reminds me of the fact that a lot of other communities around the region look to you and I.
Right.
They look toward Tallahassee and say, hey, Sharon, I know you're Tallahassee Central, but we have needs over here in Liberty County or Taylor County, wherever. You're looking in their direction too, aren't you?
Well, absolutely, because those are our counties. You know, we've got 12 counties out of the central part of the panhandle, and so we want to make sure that they don't ever feel like a stepchild, that they feel just as much supported as the folks here in Leon County do, even though our our strongest physical presence is here in Leon County, and I would dare say most of our activities and disasters and whatnot occur here in Leon County, but that's due to the population and the fact that this is this is where most of the people live here in the central part of the Panhandle. Mm. But yes, we definitely want to make sure that all of our other counties feel just equally as supported. Mm.
That is an important point. And Sharon, you and I talked about some of the ways in which the American Red Cross is empowered, not just with money and personnel, but volunteerism. A lot of the people who come your way and say, hey, what can I do to help? And this was a question that William asked me earlier this morning, came by way of Facebook. And William said, if I'm just an everyday citizen, in an emergency, what's the best thing? How can I best help?
You can come join the Red Cross. over 90% of our workforce is made up of volunteers. Actually, that number's probably low. It's probably about 95% at this point. In the last 6 weeks, we've had over 13,000 boots on the ground. Actually, 26 if you're going to count the boots. Each one of us have two legs there. But so it's incredibly important that our volunteers, that people come volunteer with us. I'm so proud of our community. I have to tell you that during the week before and right during Irma, we trained over 1,000 new volunteers that came and took our just-in-time training. Mm. And many of those people that came and took the training were able to then help us in the mini shelter. We opened up 32 shelters in our 12-county area. Which is a feat that has never happened.
It's remarkable.
During the height of Irma, I think it was since Sunday night, throughout the state of Florida, over 200,000 people were in shelters across our state. And so I can't overemphasize the importance of our volunteers. And you said something that made me think back to a statement that we always made. Volunteering with Red Cross gives ordinary people, just like me and you, the opportunity to do extraordinary things. And we saw example after example of people that were brand new volunteers that would come in and their whole, it was like a life-changing experience because they were able to go do something and see right firsthand the difference that they made in somebody's life.
So being prepared then, Sharon, includes this idea that the organizations that we can be a part of any day of the week operate 365.
Right.
I mean, it's not just during storms that we think of you and the Red Cross folks. We can think about you every day of the week and think about how we can continue our own preparedness, maybe by getting some training, huh?
Absolutely, training. And one of the things, people think of Red Cross during the big disasters, the hurricanes and whatnot, but the biggest disaster that we respond to on an everyday basis is single-family house fires. And I'm going to jump back to when you were talking about if resources were, you know, if money was no object, what would we want? I would want every home, every residence in our area to be equipped with working smoke alarms. And then I would also have fire hydrants throughout every county to where there was no place that the water wasn't readily available for our firefighters.
You just got a big shout out and an amen from the chief over here on that.
They're our first partners that we work with on a daily basis, responding to single-family house fires. And I would dare say, too, that statistics would show that we lose more lives in fires, home fires, than we do in these big disasters. You know, and so it's critical that people stop and realize that's another one of our big disasters that we need to be prepared for and work towards. And so, therefore, going back to the volunteers, we need volunteers on a daily basis to help with these because our volunteers go out in the middle of the night. It doesn't matter if it's 2 o'clock in the morning or 2 o'clock in the afternoon. When we get the call from the central dispatch, our partners right next door to us, our volunteers respond and make sure that they're there with that family during their darkest moment.
Mm. Here's a related question, Sharon, and this is open to all of you. Apart from hurricanes or in addition, what do you think is Tallahassee's biggest severe weather threat?
I'll take that one, Brian.
Well, and I just wanted to tag on to the volunteer thing first real quick and to help supplement Sharon and to help our community all year long. You know, Leon County Government does have a volunteer center, Volunteer Leon,
If people are looking for opportunities, they can call our volunteer center, 606-1970 or www.volunteerleon.org. They can get placed with the Red Cross or other organizations that help in disasters. If they want to help in the libraries or anywhere else, they can help with volunteer placement across the spectrum in our community. Again, that's just another way that the county is there to help 365.
Let's repeat that phone number,
606-1970.
Leon County Volunteer Center.
Natural disasters other than hurricanes, Mother Nature seems to go in these cycles. You know, I was thinking this morning about it. You know, the last few events we had strong windstorm, I think it was June of 2015, that hit in the Clarn area, and then we had Hermine, and then we had our January windstorm, and now Irma. You think back prior to that, 94, 2001, 2008, we had some flood events. So Mother Nature, she takes these mood swings with us, I guess, if you will, you know, where it's water and wind. And those are our two biggest threats in our area. Now, there's been a lot of good efforts towards flood mitigation. Cascades Park is a good example of a dual-use facility. It's there for our community, the entertainment and the beauty of it all, but it's also a flood retention facility to help mitigate those impacts. Flooding definitely is a risk for, you know, we've seen that happen in other places here recently, not just the Houston experience, but Baton Rouge had serious flooding, South Carolina a couple years back. Certainly, we are subject to that. We experienced flooding during Tropical Storm Fay in 2008. We were very lucky in 2012 when Debbie came across. Leon County was very lucky, I should say.
When you place a document in someone's hand, it should reach more than their head. It needs to reach their heart with compelling visuals and dramatic presentations right down to the paper it's printed on. Rapid Press reaches the hearts of thousands of people every day with commercial printing and mailing services for organizations that feed and house children, for businesses that bring vital products and services to our community, and for theaters, festivals, and orchestras reaching bigger audiences and bringing joy to life. Rapid Press, commercial printers since 1983.
For digital printing, offset printing, finishing, and mailing services, reach for Rapid Press. When you're ready to share your vision, excite your customers, and reach the hearts of your audience, reach for Rapid Press. You'll find them online at rapidpress.com or call 893-7346. 893-7346. Rapid Press, the power of print.
Hi, I'm Jerry.
And I'm Pete.
And we're with the Jerry Thigpen Trio, and you're listening to Tallahassee Talks with Brian Cerny.
Most of the bulk of that rainfall, nearly 30 inches, fell over Wakulla County. We were in like the 12 to 15 inches rain over southern Leon. But flooding outside of the wind impacts from, you know, severe thunderstorms, flooding is probably our next biggest threat that we need to be aware of and just be on alert for when Mother Nature's mood swing changes from
and
wind
to water.
You know
what? That reminds me of something that David Merrick shared with us recently on the show.
So that's a common buyback. Our common mitigation tactic would be a buyback where if we have a property, particularly a privately owned property, that's consistently being flooded or impacted by floods, then perhaps the best thing to do is to purchase that property and have the homeowner move somewhere else. And then, you know, and we've done this here in Tallahassee, done in Leon County. It's been a common tactic throughout Florida. And then when the water rises, because water is a tricky thing, and you cannot necessarily keep it from, it goes downhill, and that's just what it does. In the future, if that property is impacted, there's nobody there. There's not a house there at all, and then you don't have a disaster. I mean, you've got a body of water with nobody impacted. There is a process, and that usually comes through the mitigation side of things in the county or city emergency management. It depends on what grant funds are available and how severe those issues are. It's not something that necessarily a homeowner can seek out, but you know, that is an interesting segue into property owners, homeowners, renters, and we have a lot of those in Tallahassee, need to make sure that they are properly insured against all of these threats. There's a large rental population in Tallahassee. I would suspect that many of them do not carry sufficient renter's insurance. You know, the building they live in isn't theirs, but everything in their apartment is theirs, and that needs to be protected financially. Homeowners need to seriously consider about flood insurance, even if they're not in a traditional flood area, because your homeowner's policy that you buy from wherever is not going to cover any rising water at all. You have to have a specific policy for that, and that's where a lot of people get caught out. You know, you get a rising water situation, even if it's out of the ordinary. And there were some areas, for example, in Houston that were 800 and 1,000 year floods. You know, there was water in places where no one really ever thought it was going to happen. And a lot of those people are now finding they are uninsured, because if they're not carrying a national flood insurance program, you know, their homeowner's policy is going to say, sorry, we're not covering that. So now you're looking at a total loss on a house or $100,000 worth of damage, and how many people can just come up with that amount of cash to rebuild is exceedingly difficult. You know, there's a lot of problems with what we call generational homes, where people own the house outright. You know, the only people that will make you have homeowner's insurance is the mortgage company. And if you don't have a mortgage, if this was the house that your grandparents built or your parents built and was given to you, and you've lived in it, and you pay your property taxes and that's it, and it's a good deal, so there's no one there saying you have to have X amount of coverage from a homeowner standpoint, and then you get even a minor windstorm or a minor flood event, you could quickly get to the point where you're incurring damages that you can't afford to replace. And that does. It has a – I tell our students all the time a phrase. I know I'm going to get a lot of nods here. All disasters are local. You know, they're a local problem, and that's you know, that phrase has a lot of meanings. One, it's the local jurisdictions who are going to end up executing and managing that disaster, supported by, you know, the state and then the federal level. Well, that's one thing. But the other, this kind of side meaning to all disasters are local, is even inside a community like Tallahassee or Leon County, what those impacts are can be very different. Just by a few miles, from power to flooding to wind. I mean, hurricane. I mean, you hear about 140 mile an hour winds, 150 mile an hour winds. That doesn't mean if that came across Tallahassee, doesn't mean that the entire city would see that exact same wind field. You would see areas that got that and areas that got significantly less. So that locality, and that it's important for us to remember as emergency managers, but also for people to understand that, you know, it can be bad here, and then five miles away, everything can be fine. We saw that all over Houston, all over South Florida just recently.
I should point out, too, as well, that the county and city both have done a pretty nifty job of applying some of this modern technology that we love to talk about. Both city and county have apps that you can download for your phone. The city's is called Digitally.
Brian, can I speak to
please
the apps as well?
Interrupt me. I need to move on.
Red Cross has got a free emergency app that we encourage everybody to download, and it covers just about every kind of disaster that you could possibly imagine, whether it's a hurricane or wildfire, flood, you name it. And it actually walks you through what you need to do before a hurricane, during a hurricane, and afterwards. It gives you all the preparedness tips, what to put in your preparedness kit, etc. It also gives you up-to-date, real-time, where the shelters are. So if I were to open my app right now, I could see a whole spot of shelters still in Texas. I could see all the ones in Florida. I could see the ones in Puerto Rico. I could see the ones in all of our Virgin Islands, the ones for the wildfires out in California. So it's and it's got an alarm. It's got all the weather updates, so it gives you real-time weather information for any kind of severe threats that are there.
That's really very cool.
Really encourage people to download that app.
What's it called?
It's just go to the – it's a Red Cross emergency app.
Okay. So simple enough.
Yeah. Go to your app store, whether it's
Google or iPhone.
Right.
Either way,
exactly.
Android, iPhone.
The other thing as far as information for volunteering, ours is real easy to remember. If you're interested in volunteering, you go to redcross.org or you call 1-800-RED-CROSS.
I like that.
Pretty simple.
This is good for guys like me, you know.
I'd like to chime in a little bit here, too.
Please, Lauren, go ahead.
Now, we don't have an app, but with Kona, we have town hall meetings and where we pull together neighborhood leadership, and we talk about best practices.
That's excellent.
And problems neighborhoods are facing. So if one neighborhood's dealing with an issue, there's somebody else at the table who's already dealt with it and has some proposed solutions for them. And we talked a little bit about community appreciation. Annually, Kona does our Neighborhood of the Year Awards program. The neighborhood awards are presented by the city and county respectively. Kona does two awards, our Business Neighborhood of the Year and our Public Servant of the Year. For 2017, our public servant of the year were the electric linemen from the city of Tallahassee and the Talquin Electric Cooperative.
Right.
So
the thing that I like about that, too, is diversity of response to the diversity of our community. I should also mention the county's app, since we're on that topic. Citizens Connect is the name of it, and we've had the pleasure of talking with some of the most interesting people contributing their time and talent to our community, and you have that here among our panel. So I want to take this moment to thank each of you for being part of it. Leroy Peck, Kevin Peters, Jerome Gaines, David Merrick, Rob McGarrah, and Sharon Tyler, all of whom are here serving us every day, sometimes in a 24-hour period, right, Sharon, who just continue to do what they do best. But I think in the words of Chief Jerome Gaines, when he said to me, Brian, our biggest enemy is complacency. So let's not be complacent. Let's be proactive. Take opportunity with those things that have been put in front of us today. Get the app on your phone. Make the phone call. Volunteer for that training. Make sure that you're plugged in, prepared, and ready to deal with whatever comes our way. And remember that that person next door to you, that may be the one person that God puts in your path. This is your opportunity to be a servant for them. Help them think through maybe the things that you've learned. Folks, we're the production of Alcom Entertainment and Media right here in Tallahassee. We come to you every Saturday from Moose Magnificat Studios, and it's our pleasure. Our executive producer is Carl Cerny. I'm Brian Cerny. I'll be looking for you again next week. So come on, Tallahassee. Come talk to me.
So if you come to me and you say, I want to buy a house, the first thing I do is meet with you and say, okay, let's talk about this process. What can you afford? And not just purchase price, your lifestyle. What kind of lifestyle do you want to have here?
Tiffany Hamilton, broker of Eck and Hamilton Realty, talking about the real estate market in Tallahassee.
Right now, for any investor, in my opinion, affordable housing is something that we should be looking at. That means a purchase price of about $185 to $250, a rental income of about $1,000 to $1,500 max.
Realtor, broker, consultant, Tiffany Hamilton is helping home buyers, investors, and other realtors achieve their individual goals.
Hi, I'm Tiffany Hamilton. Investing in real estate or buying a home has never been more challenging. Even finding solid information you can trust can also be a challenge. That's exactly why I began my career as a realtor nearly 15 years ago, to help buyers and sellers overcome those challenges. As a broker, as a realtor, or a consultant, if I can help you achieve your goals, it would be my pleasure.
Call 850-366-8433 or online at TiffanyHamilton.com.